You know? Okay, so let me put this on. Thank you. It's tremendous pleasure to have, at last, a union card in the Union of Theorists here, the International Brotherhood of Theorists, Local 16. I don't know where the other 15 places are, but I hope they're as nice as this, but I doubt it. Let me tell you what I'm going to try to do tonight. I want to tell you about progress in understanding the universe that comes from destroying stars. So what I'm going to do is to talk about the expanding universe in which we find ourselves, and I'll show you how supernovae, these exploding stars, help answer some important questions, really rather wild questions. How old is the universe, and will the universe expand forever? You might think that those were questions for debate, or they're sort of conundrums where you just stand there and with your jaw slack. But what I want to show you is that there are really things to measure that we actually can tell which of those is the, what is the fate of the universe, what is the shape of space. Now, at first, this whole enterprise sounds preposterous. We're very small, and our perspective is very limited. Our brains, for example, have about 1 liter capacity, about a quart. And thinking about such a huge thing sounds like a recipe for injury. But small brains can contain large ideas. David has proved that, I'm sure, on many occasions. Now, on further reflection, this task seems even more preposterous. We're rather brief. As I tell the undergraduates, the duration of your life compared to the age of the universe is like the duration of a sneeze compared to the time it takes to get your degree. So, as my mother said, cover your mouth. All of recorded human history only reaches back about 10,000 years, maybe 100 generations times 100 years for the oldest person you know. Deep cosmic time stretches back 1 million times farther than that, beyond those first glimmers of civilization. So it's a completely different thing. And we have very little experience with such large stretches of time. So it doesn't make a great deal of sense to us. We don't have a good feeling for what these time periods might mean. What we really do is come in kind of late. I hate coming in late to a movie or to a play. We're coming in at the end, and we see a little frozen moment, like a tableau at the end of the play, and we're somehow supposed to construct all the dialogue, all the intricacies of the plot. Well, we might get some of the details wrong. And worse than that, we're very short. I don't know if you've noticed this. We're very short. We're so short that the Earth looks flat to us. And if we could have the first slide, I will illustrate that. All right. Technology, isn't it great? Okay. So here's a picture. It shows an observatory, but the real point is that to look at the horizon. And when you look at the horizon, sure enough, it looks flat. Now, of course, that's because we're so short. If we were taller and had a little bigger perspective, it might look something more like this. And we would see that the Earth is round. It's only because we're so short and we're looking only out to the horizon that you get from your eyes being, you know, 6 feet above the ground, well, not even, that you see a curved surface, something that's truly curved, looks flat. So we'll come back to this question of flatness and curviness in a minute. In a minute. There. Now, that is supposed to go blank at this time. Ah, there we go. Good. All right. Now that we're getting this under control, we can begin to move more rapidly. So here, for example, is a case where if you were taller, this is what your world might look like. Here's somebody who is big enough so that he knows that he lives on a curved planet. So if we lived on a really small planet, we would have the curvature would be part of our common sense, but it isn't. So again, your common sense, which is developed in the particular location where human beings happen to be, may not turn out to be such a good guide to understanding what the universe as a whole is like. These are matters for investigation and measurement, not just for intuition. Now, another way to measure the spherical shape of the Earth is by careful measurement on the surface. As the agents would say, show me the money. Or I guess you say that to your agent. But anyway, here's some money.
This is the beloved Deutschmark, which the Germans are worried about not having any more of once the euro takes over. The 10-mark note depicts Gauss, known to the world as a mathematician. He's sort of Six Sigma out on his own bell-shaped curve here. But he was also director of the Astronomical Observatory at Göttingen. And in 1801, an asteroid, which presumably did not have any prints aboard, Ceres, was discovered, and Gauss, who was then 24, worked out a superior method for predicting where this thing would be when it was seen again after it came out of the daylight. And his prediction was right on the money, and that is why he became both director of the observatory and the guy who is right on the money. Now, the backside of the 10-mark note is kind of interesting. You can see it has this measuring instrument, which is a surveyor's sextant for measuring where you are, measuring the positions of things, sun mostly. And it also has this little map down here, which shows a bunch of triangles. One of the things that Gauss did was to measure make a map of Hanover, that region of Germany. And he was able to show, he worked out how to measure the curvature of the Earth by measuring these triangles. You know that it's a little different if you measure on a flat surface than if you measure on a curved one. The flat surface is the geometry that Euclid knew. It's the geometry of a baseball diamond. It's the geometry of a cornfield. It's the geometry of a college entrance exam. But there is the geometry of curved space, too. And Gauss worked out the differences between what things would be like on a flat plane and on the surface of a sphere. On a sphere, parallel lines can meet. Lines that go north end up meeting at the North Pole. The circumference of a circle is smaller than 2 pi times the radius, because the radius is measured on that curved surface. And the angles of a triangle add up to more than 180 degrees. So those are things which are not true in flat space. Much later, Einstein used these ideas in his theory of gravity to express how matter curves space. And when I come to the end of this talk, I'll try to show you how a geometric measurement made by little ant-like critters, us, in the little piece of the universe that we can measure, is something like the survey that Gauss was able to do on a little piece of the Earth and allows you to measure the curvature, and that's connected to important things through Einstein's theory of gravity. So the trick is to overcome our limitations to gain a picture of the universe. Money itself, it turns out, is very useful, but it does not provide all the answers. Now, so we have all these disadvantages. We're very small, we live for a short time, and so on. How are we able to make any progress at all? Well, first of all, the laws of physics, which we can discover on the Earth, appear to work quite well in distant places. So, for example, atoms of the element calcium seem to behave in the same way whether they're in cheddar cheese on the Earth or in the atmosphere of a star or in some distant quasar at the edge of the universe. They seem to be governed by the same microscopic physical laws. So to explore the universe, we want to be not only able to use mountaintop observatories like this one, some ghostly figure is running around with a red flashlight, but also to understand the nature of matter and to understand what the physical laws are, what the rules of the game are. So just as much as the telescope itself, instruments where we find out what the laws are big particle accelerators, where by smashing things together at high energies, we find out what the rules of the game are. Those turn out to be very important because in the early universe, early in the history of the universe, the energy which particles had was comparable to, in fact, bigger than the energies that we can produce in these accelerators on the Earth, and our knowledge of what the laws of physics might be comes from this kind of investigation. What's more, a theoretical place like this also involves a lot of computation. Here we see someone praying that his computer will work properly. And in the field that I'm working in supernovae, people try to calculate what the properties of the interior of a star have to be so that it will explode. So these are also tools for investigation, using the laws of physics that we know from study on the Earth to apply them to astronomical objects. So we have that possibility of using the laws of physics. A second thing that we have, a second advantage that we have, is that the speed of light, while very large by earthly standards, is not infinite. Now you might think, well, is that an advantage? The speed of light, as everybody knows, is 1 foot in a nanosecond. A foot in a billionth of a second. Maybe the units are not familiar. A foot is about a third of a meter. It's a unit that's used in the United States and Liberia. Okay? All right, well, how does this help? How does this slow propagation of light help? It means that we never see things the way they are. We always see things, as the song says, the way they were. The people in the front row, for example, seem a little older to me than the people in the back row, because I see the light from them in about 10 nanoseconds, whereas it takes a couple hundred nanoseconds for the light to bounce off the people in the back and come up here. So I don't see you as you are, I see you as you were. Maybe it's because they reserved the front row for the dignitaries. I don't know, but anyway, the back row seems to be very young. Now, that's just being silly. But on the astronomical scale, this connection between time and space is for real and very large. Light travel time is a very important effect. And they make a telescope into a genuine time machine. There's no hokum about it. You see into the past when you look with a telescope. So we don't really see a frozen moment that I described earlier. I said there was a kind of a tableau. That's not quite true. We see a funny kind of slice through time and space where nearby we see the present, but far away we can only see the past. Well, let's take a look at that. Here's some... here's an object. Not too familiar to those of us from Massachusetts, but much more familiar to those of you who live out here. Amazing. Anyway, the light from the sun takes about 8 minutes to reach us. The Earth is about the size of one of these smaller sunspots on it. The so we don't get it. We don't get light instantly. We get it 8 minutes old. What about stars? If you go outside tonight, doesn't cloud up, you might see this group of stars. These are the Pleiades, which are we can pick out after coffee. It's the Seven Sisters, or in Japanese it's called Subaru, and if you don't believe that, I want you to look at the front of one of those cars. The light from these stars takes about 200 years to reach us. So when you look at those stars, which are easy to see without a telescope, binoculars, or anything, you're looking a couple hundred years into the past when the Republicans controlled both houses of Congress before. Maybe they were the Federalists, or whatever they were. Anyway, here's a glob of stars. That's a technical term. This is a globular cluster, as it's called. It's about 100,000 stars, which are held together by their own gravity. So now we're looking a little farther out. Typically, these are a few thousand, out to maybe 10,000 light years away. That means the light has taken 10,000 years to get here. The stars are milling around. They're held together by their own gravity. And the globular clusters are not distributed evenly around the sun, around our position. They're distributed mostly around the center of the Milky Way galaxy. This is nature's way of telling us that we're not at the center of the system, that we're somewhere out on the edge. The globular clusters are especially interesting because all the stars in the cluster formed at the same time, so they all began at the same time. And these are very good places to learn how old the stars are, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Now, I mentioned that we live in the Milky Way galaxy. This is not a picture of our galaxy, just as we don't have a good picture of the Earth from the surface. We don't have a good picture of the galaxy because we can't get out there. But this is a nearby galaxy that's similar to the one in which we live. It's a big spiral galaxy. And we're out near the edge, out in one of the spiral arms. So if this is, State Street in here, this would be Isla Vista out here. And we're not near the center of things. We're out at the edge. So the sun's location in our own galaxy is far from the center. The dimension across here, the time it takes light to get from one side to the other, is now about 100,000 years, so quite long compared to the human scale of things, but, as we'll see, quite short compared to the astronomical scale. All right, well, now let's get out into the deep water. where the big fish are. And now we're looking at galaxies. The things that are most conspicuous in this picture are not individual stars, although there are some. Those are in the foreground in our galaxy. But big gangs of stars, about 100 billion stars apiece, these big fuzzy things, which are galaxies. This is a nearby cluster of galaxies, the so-called the Virgo cluster, in the direction of the constellation Virgo, but way behind it. And the typical distance to these galaxies is something like 50 to 100 million years, light years. So the light's taken 50 to 100 million years to get here. So when the light left those galaxies, dinosaurs were roaming the Earth, surfing in Santa Barbara, or whatever they were doing. And it's galaxies all the way out to the edge of the universe. Although most of the matter in the universe is not in the luminous stars of the galaxies, nevertheless, the things that we see that mark the properties of the universe are galaxies, and that's what I'll be talking about. And that's what was on the cover of Newsweek magazine last week. Amazing that any kind of scientific subject of any type would make it onto such a magazine. Pretty good. Okay, and farther out, here's a picture in the Coma cluster of galaxies. This is a picture taken with the Hubble Space Telescope. Because the space telescope is above the Earth's atmosphere, it doesn't have to look up through that wiggly ocean of air, and it's able to take much sharper pictures than you can from the ground. And as I'll describe, that's a very important new tool that we've got. Galaxies and clusters collide, and they may collide and join together. This galaxy sort of eats each other up in a kind of cosmic cannibalism. And this picture is one, is a picture of two galaxies actually in the process of colliding as imaged with the Hubble Space Telescope. That's about 300 million light years away. So we're looking well into the past, far back into geological time. But we can look farther back than any geological time, because we can see galaxies from which the light was emitted before the Earth was formed. We're beginning here to look at galaxies which are deep into the universe, about 3 billion years into the past, 3 billion light years away. And as I'll show you, some stars don't last for a billion years. So the actual constituents of these galaxies, these fuzzy little guys here, are not there anymore. Some of the stars that were there when the light was emitted have gone through their evolution. Some of them have become supernovae. Others have died more quietly and are not there anymore. Well, this is the limit of observation. This is about as far as we can see now. It's not the limit of the universe, but it's the limit of what we can do. This is the so-called Hubble Deep Field. It was obtained with the Hubble Space Telescope by staring at an inconspicuous piece of the northern sky for about 100 hours, about 100 orbits with the space telescope, which was as much as anybody could stand, basically. And what you see is, in a region where, from the ground, we could only see that star, this galaxy, it's a wall-to-wall galaxies. You are seeing out to a region where, near and far, you're seeing galaxies almost everywhere you look. There's hardly a piece of this sky that doesn't have some little fleck in it. And almost all those little flecks, including these little tiny ones, are very distant galaxies imaged with the Hubble Space Telescope. So we're seeing back into, we're seeing back two-thirds of the way, or maybe more, back toward the Big Bang, back toward the beginning of time. The Hubble Space Telescope has the advantage that it's above the Earth's atmosphere, so it makes these exquisitely sharp images, but it's a small telescope. It's only about 1/16th the area of the big telescopes, the biggest telescopes on the ground, so it takes a long time for it to gather enough light to make the images, and it's very hard for it to gather enough light so that we can spread it out and analyze it. The big telescopes on the ground turn out to be very important in measuring the light from galaxies or, as we'll see, from supernovae that the Hubble Space Telescope can detect. But this combination, which is brand new, and we've really only had it for the last few years, of the space telescope and giant telescopes on the ground has proved very powerful and really has broken open some problems that I want to tell you about. Okay, so the big telescopes on the ground have some special features. They can do things like take the light from a distant galaxy and spread it out into a rainbow, and we can measure that. That turns out to be extremely powerful. simple physical principles that are established on the Earth reveal the nature of the universe by this kind of measurement. So, for example, on the Earth, whoops, that's my union card. On the Earth, if I were really a theorist, I wouldn't have to even show you this. On the Earth, if you take some calcium, chalk, limestone, Swiss cheese, whatever it is, and you heat it up enough, you find that at a certain color, a certain wavelength, down in the ultraviolet, you get some nice strong emission from calcium. If you look at the light from a star, the spectrum that you get, the rainbow that you get, is more complicated. It has a bunch of features in it, all these wiggles, which are due to atoms in the atmosphere of the star, which operate according to exactly the same principles in a distant star as they do in a lab on the Earth. And in fact, that's how we can identify the chemistry of distant objects. Here, for example, you can see that it's at exactly the same place. Of course, I drew this diagram, you know. But it's exactly the same place where you see absorption in this graph of the light from the star. It's the place where the calcium emits. That identifies the element calcium. We know that there's calcium, that same chemical element, in the atmosphere of stars, including the sun, but also many other stars. Now, that's interesting enough. That's how we know that what the chemistry of the universe is. That's how we know what stuff is made of. But there's also something much more interesting about the motion of stars and galaxies, which we can measure from spectra. It's a familiar effect on the surface of the Earth. If you were a hitchhiker, for example, not recommended, of course, but if you were a hitchhiker and you stood by the side of the road, as the cars go by, you hear this characteristic sound. A car goes, vroom. And you put out your thumb again, it goes, vroom. And this goes on again, vroom. And the sound is the sound of the engine and the tires, and it goes from a high pitch to a low pitch. It goes from vroom to vroom as it goes by. And that's a change in the pitch that you hear because the car is moving toward you at first and moving away from you afterwards. That's a very familiar effect. There's a similar effect for light, which is not so familiar. The color or the wavelength of the atom's emission depends on whether the star is approaching you or receding from you. It's shifted a little bit to higher pitch if it's coming toward you, or to lower pitch as it goes past. The difference is that the speed of light is a million times as big as the speed of sound, so the effect is a million times smaller. So that's why the effect is a legend for railroad whistles and not for their headlights. Okay? You don't notice that lonesome headlight glow. Now, for galaxies, you can measure the velocity from the shift in these spectrum lines. So here's a spectrum, one of 25,000 that my graduate student measured. Good fellow. And it's kind of a crummy looking thing. It's the light taken and spread out. And here's the same star that I showed you a second ago. The idea is that if you shift it toward the red, eventually it matches up very well. The same lines are present, the same chemical elements are present. They're just shifted in wavelength because the galaxy is moving away from us. In this particular case, the galaxy is moving at about 15% of the speed of light, which is not negligible. It's, 0.15 foot per nanosecond. It's 46,000 kilometers per second. So that particular galaxy is moving away from us quite rapidly. Okay, so that's a real effect, and we see it. Now, this is seen in galaxies in a very interesting and systematic way. In the early decades of the century, a man with the interesting name of Vesto Melvin Slipher worked at the Lowell Observatory in Arizona. Turns out that Percival Lowell, a scion of the Boston industrialist family, was fascinated with studying life on Mars, and he had the wherewithal to do something about it. He built an observatory near Flagstaff to see what the Martians were up to. And he hired Slipher to look into the nature of the spiral nebulae, which at that time simply was not known what they were. One possibility that people thought was that they might be solar systems in formation. That people didn't know how far away they were, so they didn't know what the scale on the picture was. So they didn't know... scale on the picture? There is no scale on this picture. Well, that's the problem. So they didn't know whether this swirling thing might be a disk of planets on their way to being formed around a star, or, as we know now, that it's really a system as big as the whole Milky Way. Slipher undertook heroic efforts to get spectra of these spiral nebulae because he thought that might be a clue to what they were. He was very surprised by what he found. Almost all the spirals that he measured were moving away from the Earth. And they were moving away at velocities which were bigger than the velocities for any other kind of star in our Milky Way galaxy. So he didn't know what to make of this, but he knew this was really weird. The understanding of this came from a combination of the measurements of the velocities and measurements of distances, which came through the efforts of this woman. This is Henrietta Swan Leavitt, who worked at the Harvard College Observatory at the turn of the century. She was given by the director a boring job of looking at a huge stack of photographs taken from Harvard Station in Peru of the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is a galaxy now. Now we know it's a galaxy, which is a neighbor, actually a satellite of our own Milky Way. So Henrietta Leavitt studied pictures of this particular system of stars, and she found something quite important and slightly unexpected. What she found was that there was a relation. There were variables. She found, first of all, that there were variable stars in this. That means stars which get brighter and dimmer. And she found that they got brighter and dimmer in a very interesting and important way. She found that the stars which were brightest got bright and dimmer slowly. The stars which were dimmer, that were variables of this type, got bright and dim more rapidly. So the point is that you could tell from something that you could measure how quickly these stars cycled, whether they cycled slowly, in which case they were sort of like a big bell, they were kind of had a low note, they were things which were physically big and actually very bright. Those were the ones which were really bright. And the ones that were smaller and dimmer had a kind of faster vibration, sort of like the smaller bell. So that's an important thing because it gives you a way to tell the real brightness of a star. You see, the problem is, in our own galaxy, we don't know whether an object is nearby or far away. It's kind of hard to tell just from the brightness. Sometimes a flashlight shining in your eye looks brighter than a lighthouse that is some miles away. It's only because it's really, it only seems brighter because it's closer. It's not really brighter. You knew that. Well, in the same way, it's hard to sort these things out in our own galaxy. But the Large Magellanic Cloud is different because all the stars are at about the same distance from us. So the apparent brightness gives the true brightness. So what Henrietta Leavitt found was that the bright Cepheids had long periods and the dim ones had short periods, varied more quickly. And this discovery led to an understanding of the spiral nebulae that Slipher had been measuring, and eventually to the nature of the universe. And the way that happened was by using this telescope. This is the 100-inch telescope. It's as big as the Space Telescope. And it was at the best site going at the time, Mount Wilson, up above Pasadena. It's no longer the best site in the world because of the growth of that little village of Los Angeles down there, which have made the skies rather bright, but it's still atmospherically an excellent place for astronomical observing. At that observatory, this guy, Edwin Hubble, used the 100-inch telescope to look for the same kinds of stars that Henrietta Leavitt had found, only in more distant galaxies. So he was using the best instrument available to look for individual stars of the kind I've been talking about, whose brightness he would be able to measure from their periods, using the 100-inch telescope at Mount Wilson. You're no longer allowed to smoke in the dome. That's out. Well, he found them in M31 in this galaxy. The Cepheids there turned out to be about 100 times fainter than the Cepheids in the Large Magellanic Cloud. That means that the distance to this spiral nebula was about 10 times bigger than the distance to the Large Magellanic Cloud. We have an estimate of the distance to the Large Magellanic Cloud. It's about 165,000 light years. That means that this thing is about 2 million light years away. So it's this chain of reasoning, by finding objects that you could calibrate nearby and then detect in a distant object, that allows you to say that these things are not part of our own Milky Way galaxy. They are distant objects which are as big as the Milky Way. So there isn't one big glob of a galaxy and with us in it. The universe is made up of individual galaxies, sort of like citizens of the universe, large and small, which are separated by millions of light years. Now, you will recall that Slipher had measured velocities for these, for some galaxies. Oh, I had the art department do this for me. Okay. you'll recall that Slipher had measured velocities for galaxies from the shift of their spectra. Hubble measured distances to galaxies using Cepheids, and then eventually the brightest stars in galaxies, and then eventually the properties of the galaxies themselves. Now, when scientists have lists of two numbers, what they do is they make a graph. So here, for example, is the bike chart, which shows cost of bicycle this way and the urge to wear spandex on the other axis. Hubble used the same approach. And he used the velocities, which Slipher had been measuring, those are shown up on this axis, against the distances that he'd been judging out here. So this is the plot. This is old. This is from 1929. And it shows that as you go farther away, farther out on this axis, the velocities get bigger. And the way the velocity is defined is that a redshift is positive. So the galaxies are moving away from us. And the farther away you look, the faster they're moving away. In fact, you can draw a line here in which the velocity is proportional to the distance. Or you could write an equation. The velocity is some number times the distance. That number is the slope of this line, and we call it the Hubble constant. Hubble used to use the letter K, which I think we ought to bring back. But anyway, Hubble used the letter K. Now, what do you make of this? Well, this is not quite common sense. But it is the observation that shows you that we live in an expanding universe. Most of the undergraduates, and I believe most of the faculty at my institution, are rather self-centered. And they think that the Hubble law, the velocity proportional to the distance and everything moving away from us, means that the universe is organized this way. This is the so-called egocentric universe. But if there's any lesson to be learned from our location in the universe, or any lesson from the history of astronomy, it's that we're probably not really at the pivot of things, but that we're at a typical place. The Earth isn't the center of the solar system. You knew that before you came in. The solar system is not at the center of our galaxy. And it seems to me we would be slow learners if we didn't realize that it's entirely possible that our galaxy somehow doesn't occupy the central place in the universe. Nevertheless, it is where we stand, and you can imagine that we can make a map of the universe from where we are that's as good as anybody else's map. This is what I call the Chelsea-centric map of the Earth. This is one in which Stanford, apparently, is at the center, and everything else is measured out from there. But what you realize from looking at a map like this is that anybody else is just as good. You could have made the map from the point of view of any other place on the surface of the Earth. So instead of thinking that we have some special position in the universe, let's assume the complete opposite, that our view is completely typical, that everybody else sees the same thing that we do. Now you might say, well, how can that be? They're all moving away from us. Well, I wouldn't have brought it up if I didn't have a way to persuade you. And that is, I've made my own little universe here. It's a cheap one. It's a two-dimensional universe. And it's on a transparency. Okay, kind of a two-bit god. What can I say? You know, here's my universe. And I made a second one, which is similar, only I pushed the enlarge button a little bit. So this is the same universe, only just stretched out in every dimension by I don't know, 5%, something like that. What does it look like? Well, what it looks like to each point, if I go up to this big green place up here, joke in New England, it doesn't look like much of anything. What's the matter with me? What have I done? Top? I don't know. Anyway, let's go over here. Ah, looks good. Oh, yes, that looks good. Everyone's trying to get out of Cambridge. Well, it must be Friday afternoon. Okay. It looks like expansion away from this point. But there's nothing special about that point except that I drew a circle around it. I could go down here to this orange one. Well, looks like expansion away from there. Or I could go over to this blue one. That's funny in New England. And it looks like everybody's leaving New Haven. Oh, good. Well, what's the point? The point is that this picture, in which no point has any special point, any special property, looks like expansion away from each of the places. Every galaxy in an expanding universe, where the whole space is getting bigger, sees all its neighbors moving away from it, and the more distant ones moving away more rapidly. It's as if I had the power, vested in me by the chancellor of this campus, to double the size of this room. And if that happened, your neighbors would all be moving away from you. It's nothing about you. Okay? They don't even, you know, they may not even know you. They just sat down there. But your neighbors would all be moving away from you, and the people who are more distant would appear to be moving away from you more rapidly. So we think that that's the way it is in the real universe, in which we actually live. That this is the universe is not just a cheap two-dimensional transparency, of course, but it looks like the real universe in which we live has galaxies moving away from one another as if the whole space is expanding. We can make a measurement for 25,000 galaxies, and I had a graduate student do this, Juan Lin, good fellow. From our point of view, which is not a unique point of view, but it's the only one we've got, you can plot out for each of these 25,000 galaxies, each shown as a little dot here, where it is, east and west, and then in distance, in the third dimension, by measuring its velocity. And so what's done for each galaxy is to plot how far away it is by measuring the velocity. The velocity is proportional to the distance. And the Hubble constant is the thing that relates velocity and distance. It's the scale on this map. Not to spoil all the suspense, but this distance, about to here, is about 1 billion light years. So it takes light from the typical galaxy in this sample about 1 billion years to get here. So it's a pretty good sized chunk of the nearby universe. But it's really just the nearby universe. Now, we have this Hubble law. The velocity is proportional to the distance. And one of the things I advertised about this talk is that somehow I was going to tell you how old the universe is. And the sense in which I want to tell you how old the universe is by connecting these two things, by connecting the velocity and the distance. And it's not too complicated. Although, if you are allergic to algebra, I hope that you'll just close your eyes for a moment here. How do you do this problem? Well, it's really not too tricky. Especially if you have a theorist union card. Here are two galaxies. And imagine you're on this one looking at that one, or you could be on that one looking at this one. It doesn't matter. You stand here and you look at that one, and it's moving away from you with some velocity that's given by the Hubble constant times the separation between the two, the distance between the two. Now, you can ask yourself, how long, in the words of the song, has this been going on? And the answer is, the time is the distance, the separation, divided by the velocity. That's how long it would take if you moved at that speed to get this far away. So it's a kind of measure that tells you how long the expansion has been going on. Now, the interesting thing is, if we're talking about a situation where the Hubble law prevails, that means that the velocity is proportional to the distance. It's some number times the distance. So I can put that down in here. And you see that it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a nearby galaxy or a distant one. It doesn't matter whether R is big or small. It doesn't matter what R is. The time is the same for all the galaxies near and far. What that means is, if you look at a nearby galaxy, it's moving away slowly. If you look at one twice as far away, it's moving twice as fast. So the time it would take to kind of get there, in some sense, is the same. So this is a way to talk about the age of the universe in terms of the expansion rate. And the age of the universe measured this way is 1 over the Hubble constant, and in the right units, it turns out to be something between 10 and 20 billion years. Now, you might think, people have been working on this since 1929. How come they don't know this to better than plus or minus 10 billion years? Well, okay, I'll try to convince you that we're doing a little bit better than that. Now, this isn't the only way to estimate the age of the universe. People have been at this for a long time. This is a really interesting question. Maybe you could turn off the projector for a minute. It's a really interesting question. One of the earliest attempts to do this was done by James Usher in 1658. He took the biblical chronology that has, you know, Jared was born when his father had lived 65 years, and how old Enoch was born when Jared was 162 when he had Enoch. That's interesting. Anyway, and Adam, according to this, lived to be 930. Anyway, you add all that stuff up back to Adam, and according to James Usher, you find that the time of beginning was the evening of October 22nd, 4004 BC. So in that picture, the universe would be about 6001 years old. Yeah, that's right. Well, some number. Yeah, 6001 years old. Well, what about the value from the Hubble constant? Based on the relation between the velocity and the distance that we see nearby, the Hubble law, we get an age that I said was on the order of some tens of billions of years. We'd like to do better than that. And so what I want to tell you now is how people have used the Hubble Space Telescope for some of these ideas that I've talked about to do a better job of measuring the size and age of the universe. So going back to the slides, here's the Hubble Space Telescope. Maybe it's appropriate to show it a little out of focus at the beginning, but now it's working great. Now it's working great. From the ground, those Cepheid variable stars that I was talking about get blurred into the background, into their neighbors, once the galaxies are far away. But with the space telescope above the atmosphere, you can distinguish one star from another much farther out. And so what people have done, including Wendy Friedman at the Carnegie Observatory, is to look at nearby galaxies. Here's a picture taken with the Hubble Space Telescope of a galaxy in the Virgo cluster, about 50 million light years away. And you can see quite clearly that you can see individual stars in that galaxy. By taking a series of pictures with the space telescope, you can see which of these is variable. Here's a picture that shows you that. In this exciting field in the galaxy M100, here's a picture of that blown up, and there's a star in the middle of it. And if you look at here's the same field at a different time. It's the same field at a different time. The star is actually varying. It's changing in brightness. And by taking repeated pictures, you find that the star gets brighter and dimmer, just like the Cepheid variable stars that Hubble measured in the Andromeda galaxy, just like the Cepheid variable stars that Henrietta Leavitt measured in the Large Magellanic Clouds. And by comparing the brightness of this star to those, you can figure out how far away the Virgo cluster is. Now, that works quite well. It turns out that this is about 100,000 times fainter than the stars in the Large Magellanic Cloud, so it's about 300 times as far away, about 50 million light years away. It sounds like a lot. But in fact, the expansion velocity of the universe at that distance is only about 1,500 kilometers per second. Turns out that the individual galaxies don't all exactly obey the Hubble law. They're kind of milling around. They're pulled by their neighbors. They're pushed one way or another. And so they have velocities which turn out to vary one to another by something like 500 kilometers a second. So at 1,500 compared to 500, not so big. It means that the variations are quite big. It means that by measuring one galaxy, you don't really get a very good measure of the Hubble constant. What you would like to do is either measure lots of galaxies, which is extremely expensive in terms of observing time, or measure galaxies that are farther away so that the expansion velocity is bigger and that 500 kilometers a second of milling around doesn't matter very much. You need something brighter than the Cepheids in order to do this. And the thing that's brighter than the Cepheids are the supernovae, Here, David told the story of the first supernova seen in our galaxy, and it was seen in B.C. And here's Throg, or whatever his name is, going up here. He says, starlight, star bright, and now he's beginning to sweat. First supernova I see tonight. There are historical records of stars exploding in our own galaxy and becoming brighter than the planets, which you go out and see tonight, nearly as bright as the full moon in some extraordinary cases. Those are very rare, though. They only take place every 100 years or so in our own galaxy, which is why we haven't seen one since 1604. But we can see them to very large distances, even with fairly modest telescopes on the ground. Here's a supernova. When I was a graduate student and when I had to do what people told me, I was studying this supernova in 1972, supernova 1972E. Here's a galaxy, 100 billion stars or so, and one of those stars exploded, became for a month or so nearly as bright as the rest of the stars in the galaxy. One star becomes about as bright as a billion stars. That's about 10,000 times brighter than a Cepheid variable, so that you should be able to see them 100 times as far away. So they are really good, in principle, for measuring distant things. What you need is for somebody else to go measure Cepheid variables in that galaxy. Alan Sandage has done that with the Hubble Space Telescope. He's measured the distance to that galaxy, and that allows you to use the measurements, which were excellent measurements, if I do say so myself, from 1972, of how bright the supernova was, to figure out how bright supernovae are and to use them to measure the distances to more distant ones. So the supernovae can be used as kind of standard candles, standard light bulbs, whose brightness can be used to measure their distance. Well, they're not perfect standard candles. It's a little like if you imagine navigating up a coast using the brightness of a lighthouse to tell you how close to the coast you are. I looked in a navigation book, and here's what, whoops, well, here's a supernova, another one, sorry. Here's another one in a nearby galaxy. This is with the Hubble Space Telescope, a beautiful galaxy about the same distance as the M100, the one I was showing you a minute ago with the Cepheid in it. And this is supernova 1994D, which is in the same galaxy. So it's one star becoming very bright. And as I say, you can try to measure the distance of these things the way you might do it in measuring the distance to a lighthouse. Now, here's what a navigation book says about that. It says in italics, do not attempt to estimate the distance of a light by its apparent brightness. The reason for that is that if you make a mistake while navigating up a coast, you die. Whereas in cosmology, if you make a mistake in measuring the distance to a galaxy, you just write another paper later. So it's a much more serious business. Nevertheless, what we're doing is we're trying to measure the distances to objects by their apparent brightnesses. And there's a relationship between for the supernovae between how rapidly they get bright and get dim and how bright they really are. That has helped us figure out how to improve their use as distance measurements, and that's what I want to talk about for the last little bit. Here's a Hubble diagram for supernovae. Let's see. If I do that, that's better. And if the velocity were proportional to the distance, you'd get a line here. The line tells you just that the brightness of these things get, as you go farther away, they get dimmer by the inverse square. And if the supernovae were perfect standard candles, all the same brightness, they would all lie right on that line. You will notice that they kind of lie on that line, but they kind of jiggle around. When my graduate student does this right, we use the fact that some of the supernovae get bright and dim quickly, some get bright and dim slowly, and that tells us how bright they are. And then the supernovae behave much better. They line right up on this line. And by measuring the distances to some of the nearby supernovae with Cepheids, we can find out where this line crosses the axis, and that turns out to be tell us the value of the Hubble constant. The value of the Hubble constant in astronomers' mysterious units that we get is about 67 kilometers per second per megaparsec of distance. What that really means is that the age of the universe that you get that way, the expansion age, is about 14 billion years. So the supernovae give you a very nice measure of that, and it's a measure that we think is quite reliable. Now, let me tell you about the fate of the universe.
Something's happening here.
The fate of the universe depends on a kind of balance between the expansion and gravity. So to answer the second question, will the universe expand forever, we need to kind of think about what's making the universe expand and what would stop it. Very luckily on television, in fact on commercial television, they have they had a recent set of demonstrations of this called the World Series, in which they launched a number of objects into the atmosphere and they fell back down. So for example, there were pop-ups in which the ball went up a little way and came back down. There were a number of home runs in which the ball went off into the night at some high speed. And it's even true that Tim McCarver said that ball went into the night like a rocket. There's some that seem to go off very rapidly. Well, okay. What's going on? Well, we know that what's happening is when you launch a ball up, the gravity's pulling on it and can pull it back down. Some cases, the ball's launched with more speed and it goes for a much longer time. We don't really know what's going to happen. And we know that in the case where balls are really launched like a rocket, where rockets are launched, you can send something up from the surface of the Earth with enough speed so it never comes back. Now, the universe also behaves according to the same sorts of physical laws. The separation between galaxies, which I talked about a minute ago when I talked about the Hubble law, I said that the universe is expanding. That means the distance between things is getting bigger. So if you start back at the Big Bang, things are getting bigger. The separation between any two galaxies is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But gravity is pulling them back. If the expansion is not too fast or the gravity is strong, then this can turn around and like a pop-up, the universe will just go for a while from a Big Bang at the beginning to a Big Bang spelled backwards. They're going to have dib at some future time where all the galaxies will be back in the same place. Or you could have something that's sort of like that home run where the galaxies are separating but at a slower and slower rate as time goes by. Or you could have a universe which is expanding so fast that gravity really doesn't have very much effect and that it just coasts on out forever. Now, so there's a way to talk about this. The gravitation is balanced against motion. The gravitation is measured by how much stuff there is in the universe, what the density is in the universe, and it's balanced up against the rate of expansion, which is the Hubble constant that I was talking about before. If you think we don't know this one very well, you should take a look at how well we know this one, which is terrible. But nevertheless, the game is to measure the gravitation against the motion. Now, our goal is to turn this deep philosophical question, will the universe expand forever, into the measurement of a single number. Then we would feel like we knew what we were talking about. And the way we do that is by taking this balance and saying there's a particular density at which things really are exactly balanced. We call that the critical density. And we write this scary-looking last letter of the Greek alphabet, omega, eschatology. And the idea is that we measure the real density of the universe and compare it to the critical density. So this is a way, the value of this number is the answer to the question, will the universe expand forever? If the density is low, then the universe will expand forever. That means if the real density is small compared to the critical density, omega is less than 1, that'll expand forever. If omega is big, that means the density is high compared to the critical density, and it will contract eventually, so the expansion that we see today will turn around and become a contraction at some day in the future. And omega equals 1 is right on the foul line, and it turns out, as in baseball and tennis, on the foul line is in. The universe will continue to expand, but at an ever slower rate. So this fancy question, will the universe expand forever, becomes this kind of narrow question, what's the value of omega? Well, okay, what's the value of omega? How do we answer that? Well, we skip through a few slides because it's getting late. We skip that one. We skip that one. We skip. Gee, that's a good one. Yeah, we skip that one too. That's just my life's work. Never mind. Never mind. What? Oh, you like these slides? Oh, all right. Let me tell you why I put these slides in here, even though we're in a hurry. Well, I'm in a hurry. Oh, I'm not in a hurry. I'm not going anywhere. The idea is that this age that I've talked about of about 14 billion years for the expansion time of the universe can be compared to the ages of the oldest stars. We know how to measure the ages of stars because we know how stars are born, we know how they mature, we know how they die. Supernovae are the deaths of stars. Here's a place where stars are forming in the Large Magellanic Cloud, and one of the stars in the neighborhood went through its whole evolution rather quickly, and it exploded so that the light got here on a Tuesday in 1987. And that was supernova 1987A, the star that was in that location. This one isn't there anymore. It exploded and the light got here in 1987. Now, one of the things that we can do by looking at the site of that explosion is to tell how far away the Large Magellanic Cloud is. Here's a picture taken with the Hubble Space Telescope now, 10 years later, that shows the supernova debris and then some complicated ring-like structure, which we think has to do with things that happened maybe 30,000 years before the star actually exploded. That's gas which was lost from the star before the explosion. A little closer view, done with fake color, through the miracles of modern computer technology, is shown here. This is the green thing is the actual debris from the supernova. These complicated and interesting rings are material which was lost from the supernova before the explosion. Now, the thing that is important for our story is that by measuring the size of this ring and the time it took to light up after the explosion, we can actually calculate how far away supernova 1987A is. And the interesting thing about it is that the distance that you get that way, about 165,000 light years, is the same as the distance which people have been using as the foundation of the Cepheid scale, the Cepheids which are used to measure extragalactic distances. So it means that the supernovae also provide a kind of test of whether this whole story hangs together. And here is the latest picture we have of the supernova, in which we can actually begin to see that the debris is not just a blob, it's some curious thing that looks just like a question mark. Why is that? I don't know. This is radioactive material which was ejected from the explosion. It's expanding out at about 3,000 kilometers a second. There's faster stuff that's very cold and which is just about to bang into this ring around the supernova. Okay. Well, the reason why I bring this up is that The reason that I bring this up is that it helps us establish the distance scale nearby, and it also gives us some clue about the ages of stars. This was a very massive star that lived very fast. A star like the Sun lives a much longer life. A star like the Sun probably lives for about 10 billion years. So stars form out of clouds of gas and dust. Now, here's the Orion Nebula. That's a big cloud of gas that you can see later tonight. And in it, in this dusty, gassy region, there are new stars being formed. So here you can actually see it going on. Here's a kind of dusty region. And these new blue hot stars have just formed out of that cloud, that particular cloud. Here's another place where stars are forming. This is this beautiful picture from the Space Telescope of another big gas cloud in our own galaxy where stars are forming. They're dusty regions, these kind of pillars of gas and dust, with new stars that are being formed that are illuminating all of this beautiful thing. It is good that I slowed down. Yeah, this is good stuff. And here you can see that these clouds are kind of translucent. This is a dust cloud. The dust absorbs the light from the stars, but you can begin to see some of them. It absorbs the blue light more than the red light, so when you look through these clouds, the stars that you see appear to be red. Seeing into these clouds is possible if you work at longer and longer wavelengths, if you actually work in the infrared, and there are many new detectors being built. And in Santa Barbara, there's a big company that makes infrared detectors that are capable of making measurements like that in astronomical objects. So we're beginning to learn more about how the stars form. Now, the reason why I wanted to bring that up is that the stars form, they actually generate energy in the center that balances out the energy that's being radiated. The way they do that is by turning the elements out of which they're made, mostly hydrogen, into the next more complicated element, helium. Turns out this is a very delicate balance, as shown here, similar to the one I showed a minute ago. The ingredients for this nuclear cooking have more mass than the product. That is, the hydrogen atoms that go in weigh more than the helium nuclei that come out. And the balance, the difference, shows up as energy, according to this well-known equation. This equation is usually used by cartoonists to show science is hard and you don't understand it. In fact, it's an equation in which the thing on the left is equal to the thing on the right. The amount of energy that you get out is equal to the mass difference between the ingredients and the product times the speed of light squared. Early in the talk, I said that the speed of light was really big. The speed of light squared is big, big. And that means that for a very small amount of change in mass, you get a lot of energy out. By the change of hydrogen to helium in the cores of stars, a star like the Sun can last for 10 billion years. So stars are long-lived because the energy yield of this kind of reaction is very large. Now, the reason that that's interesting is that the Sun will eventually become a red giant after about 10 billion years and then puff off its atmosphere. The Sun will become a white dwarf, a little hot star in the center. The Earth will have been evaporated by this time, but anyway. So you better write down if you have any good thoughts. But the Sun will puff off most of its outer atmosphere. There's another one of these so-called planetary nebulae, which is a star which has puffed off its outer atmosphere. It's a beautiful picture from the Hubble Space Telescope and very similar to the picture that I showed you of 87A. So it's not a miracle that these things can be puffed off. We think that the real shape of this is something like an hourglass, where there's kind of a narrow waist and then two cones coming out from it. And probably 87A, which is a different kind of star, nevertheless has a similar sort of shape. So that's what the Sun is going to be like in 10 billion years after it becomes a red giant. We can look at the stars in globular clusters, which turn out to be the oldest stars in our own galaxy. And it turns out that the stars which are just becoming red giants, and in this globular cluster, you can see them. Here are the red ones. The bright red ones are stars which have just become red giants. And by looking at the ones which are just on the process of doing that, just beginning to be red giants, you can tell how massive they are, how old they are. It turns out that in the oldest globular clusters in our galaxy, the stars which are doing that are just a little less massive than the Sun. They're probably about 12 billion years old, give or take. Well, that's an important thing. I said that the universe looked like it might be 14 billion years old if it's been expanding at a constant rate. That was the expansion time from the Hubble constant. This gives you about 12 billion years from the ages of the stars. That's a reasonable agreement, except that if the universe has mass in it, it hasn't been expanding at a constant rate. As I was trying to suggest, it may have been decelerating, and we want to measure how much. Okay, so the way to measure how much, now we're ready. So this story is a way of measuring how much the universe has decelerated. It's a way of measuring how much mass is in the universe. It turns out that if omega is 1, the expected value for the age of the universe would be about 9 billion years. It would be about two-thirds of the 14 billion years that I was describing as the Hubble time. So things have slowed down if the density is as high as that. Okay, let me just finish up by showing you that we really can measure something about this. What is it that we would be able to measure? Well, here's the ages of things. Okay, that's what I said. So the presence of matter curves space. So if you have, an English Bull Terrier or an elephant sitting on the couch, it kind of does something to the plaid. In Einstein's theory of general relativity, the presence of matter curves space. And what that means is the kind of thing which I talked about when I was referring to Gauss. It means that the geometry of space is different than it is in flat space. It means that the brightness of objects doesn't go exactly as the inverse square, because the circumference of a circle or the area of a sphere doesn't quite go like the distance or like the square of the distance. The inverse square law doesn't exactly apply if there's a lot of matter in the universe. So the idea is to take the supernovae, which we measure nearby, where we see that they get dimmer and dimmer as you go farther and farther out, and take that far enough out so that the geometric effect of mass in the universe would really make a difference, make a measurable difference. So we want to test whether the universe has the geometry of flat space, or whether it has enough mass in it so that the geometry is the geometry of curved space. Ah, this is supposed to be an illustration of flat space. Everybody thinks it must be flat, but let's go out and measure it. Now, the interesting thing is that these ideas are all connected by the theory of gravity. If omega is exactly 1, if the universe has exactly the closure density, then the geometry of space will be flat, just like the geometry that you learned in high school. If the density is higher, it turns out that the distant supernovae will be a little brighter. If the density is lower, the distant supernovae will be a little fainter. You either got that right or wrong. Anyway, so here's a graph that shows what you should expect. This is what I was talking about before. Nearby, the supernovae get dimmer as you go farther away, just like the inverse square law. But what you can see here is these different lines, which are meant to indicate universes in which the value of omega is different, in which there's different amounts of mass. And as you go farther away, it begins to make a difference. Just like on the surface of the Earth, if you measure a baseball field, it doesn't matter that the Earth is curved. But if you measure Wyoming, you know, it turns out it does matter. The north end of Wyoming is shorter than the south end of Wyoming. And if you try to navigate across the Pacific Ocean, you better take into account that the Earth is curved. In the same way, nearby, the inverse square law works fine no matter what the geometry is. But when you get out so that the distance to the supernova is a fair fraction, third or half of the distance back to the Big Bang, or the time back to the Big Bang, these geometrical effects begin to matter. Okay, so how do we do this? We have to find some supernovae and measure them. So let me just take 5 minutes and show you that. We can do this. We look for new stars using using big telescopes, and we can find, because there's so many galaxies, as in that Hubble Deep Field, but from the ground, we can look at thousands of galaxies at once. So even though supernovae are very rare, only one per 100 years or so per galaxy, you look at enough galaxies, you'll find one every night. In fact, here in October 8th and 9th, we used a telescope in Chile at Cerro Tololo, which has a great big electronic camera on it that looks at a big chunk of the sky, and we found 17 new supernovae in a single observing session. What that means is you can plan on the discoveries because you look at enough of them in advance. That means you can schedule follow-up observations, including observations with the space telescope that I'll show you in a second. What do these things look like? Well, they look terrible. The supernovae I showed you before were nice big dots next to a fuzzy galaxy. Here, the objects are so far away that they're all blurred together by the Earth's atmosphere. So this is the galaxy, and that's the supernova. Well, you may not believe that. Should be to your credit. Here's another set of pictures of that same object. April 3rd, this is supposed to be the galaxy, and that's the supernova. April 24th, we used an instrument that really improves the scene. Here's the galaxy, here's the supernova. And when we came back a month later, it went away. It was gone. That's a good sign, too. The supernova is supposed to get bright and dim. So that's the kind of measurement we had. How do you know that's a supernova and not some other strange thing? Well, we do the thing I said. We use the biggest telescopes we can find, in this case, the Keck telescope that Alex Filipenko at the University of California at Berkeley has been using on these things. Here's the spectrum. So he's taken the light from the supernova and spread it out into a rainbow, and it's a kind of complicated graph of the type I showed you before. Here's the supernova nearby that we judge to be of the same type and age. And you can see, although this is kind of noisy and it's got all kinds of jigs and jags on it, it looks very much like a kind of bad version of the nearby supernova. So we think that these little dots that we're detecting really are supernova explosions of the kind that we see nearby. Well, the tour de force in this has been to connect it with the Hubble Space Telescope. And to do that, the Space Telescope has to be scheduled several months in advance, so you have to tell them when and where you will discover the supernova. But by making the observations with these big electronic cameras from the ground, you can do that. You can be pretty sure that you'll find one. So this set of pictures are taken with the Hubble Space Telescope, show observations we made in April of some supernovae that we found from the ground. The field that we searched from the ground was with a big camera in Hawaii that had a field of about 30 by 30 arc minutes, about half a degree on a side. This picture is about one arc minute on a side. So the search field was 1,000 times bigger. We had a big area and lots of galaxies in it, especially when you consider the galaxies that we're talking about are miserable things like this. This is a blow-up of that particular one, and it shows there's a little dot next to it. That's the supernova. You may or may not believe me, but we've measured the spectrum of it, the way we measured the other ones. We've measured the light curve, how it got bright and dim. Here's another one, a galaxy with a supernova. And here's a supernova in which the galaxy is so faint you can't really see it very well. Here's a better picture of that one. That's the most distant supernova ever observed. It's at a redshift of 1, which means the wavelengths have been shifted by their whole wavelength. Okay, here's the light curves. So this is brand new stuff. The observations from the ground are shown here because it takes about a week to get into the Space Telescope system. They send up the instructions on Monday, which means they have to have them done on Friday because they take the weekend off. So if you discover a supernova on Thursday, too late. Too late. If you discover it on Monday or Tuesday, that's good, because then by Friday they can send the instructions. The next Monday you can get observations. So there's a gap, some cases, between the ground-based observations early on and the space telescope observations later. But in the best cases, these very nearly overlap and the measurements look real good. These beautiful light curves come from the ground and from the space telescope. And here's the one for the most distant supernova ever observed. Now, you're wondering, well, will the universe expand forever or not? Okay. Here's the graph that you might have been thinking of. Here's nearby the distance and the brightness, the redshift and the brightness, go just like the inverse square law, as you'd expect. And these different lines show what you'd expect for a universe which has nothing in it, that's the solid line, or which is dominated by matter, which is this dashed line down low, dotted line down low. The one at the top is too disgusting to discuss. Or down here, we show the difference between a universe that's completely empty, not completely empty, we're here, we know that, but anyway, nearly empty. Or here's one in which there's enough matter in the universe so that the expansion will stop, or the expansion will slow down, where the matter exactly balances the Hubble constant, exactly balances the expansion. That is, where gravity exactly balances the expansion. Now, you know, we're not in the business of betting or taking people's money, but this line, which is very, very popular, especially among theorists, and I don't want to lose my union card by saying anything incautious at this point, doesn't look like a real good bet at the present. According to the statistics of Gauss, we will give you $20 to we'll give you 20 to 1 odds against this being the right answer. So I'll give you 10 to 1 odds and take any amount of money you'd like. So that's the story at the moment. The universe is expanding, that's for sure. It has an age which looks to be around 14 billion years, but we don't know exactly. It depends on this deceleration. At the moment, we're beginning to be able to measure distant supernovae, which will tell us whether the geometry of the universe is the geometry of flat space or the geometry of curved space. That will tell us whether the universe will expand forever or not. But to finish, let me just say, here is my real conclusion about whether the universe will expand forever or not. We don't know. But we're going to find out. Thank you very much. That's nothing.